Chers amis, chers collègues, c'est pour moi un très grand plaisir que d'inaugurer cette cérémonie où nous allons d'abord faire connaissance avec le professeur Waterhouse qui nous vient du campus de Davis aux États-Unis, l'Université de Californie. Nous étions rencontrés il y a quelques années lorsque j'occupais le poste de vice-président chargé aux relations internationales. Et l'Université de Californie a des relations étroites avec l'Université de Bordeaux, en général, Berkeley, mais également le campus de Davis grâce à l'école d'œnologie bordelaise. Et nous avions débuté sous la houlette de Pierre Donnège, Pierre-Louis Tessèdre, avec Andrew Waterhouse, un certain nombre de discussions sur les échanges que nous pouvions avoir. Alain Blanchard, vice-président du Conseil scientifique, va vous présenter un petit peu plus en détail Andrew Waterhouse. Mais je suis très heureux qu'il vienne ici jusqu'à nous, d'abord pour nous faire partager sa grande connaissance du vin et des relations avec la santé. Et puis, dans un deuxième temps, et je vous invite tous à nous rejoindre, salle du Conseil, nous aurons le grand honneur de lui décerner le titre d'honoris causa de notre université. C'est bien sûr une marque de reconnaissance individuelle, mais c'est également la volonté que nos établissements nouent des liens plus forts et travaillent ensemble dans le cadre d'une véritable coopération. Donc, Alain, si tu veux bien dire quelques mots d'introduction, et puis ensuite nous écouterons le professeur Waterhouse. Merci.
Merci. Juste quelques mots très rapidement. Bien sûr, on a beaucoup de plaisir à accueillir aujourd'hui le professeur Andrew Waterhouse. On l'a déjà dit, professeur à l'Université de Californie sur le campus de Davis. Alors, j'ai reconnu quelques-uns de mes étudiants, donc je vais un peu plus dans le détail. Campus de Davis, c'est quelque chose qui sonne très fort aux oreilles des scientifiques parce qu'on sait que ça regroupe au sein de l'Université de Californie l'essentiel de la recherche dans le domaine des sciences de l'agronomie, de l'œnologie, de l'alimentation. Donc c'est un campus extrêmement important où certains d'entre nous ont fait des séjours d'ailleurs postdoctoraux. Et la venue d'Andrew Waterhouse illustre les relations extrêmement fructueuses que nous tissons avec l'Université de Californie. Et le président l'a rappelé avec les initiatives prises par le doyen de l'UFR d'œnologie, Bernard Donnèche, et puis par Pierre-Louis Tessèdre. Ces initiatives, on l'espère, vont amplifier, parce que ça a déjà commencé, elles vont amplifier en fait les échanges d'étudiants entre nos deux institutions, et ça c'est quelque chose qu'on va encourager, c'est aller dans la bonne direction et voir aller vers des formations qui pourraient être cohabilitées. Et là, ce serait un nouveau niveau de reconnaissance. Alors, à l'Université de Bordeaux 2, on se réjouit aussi que la venue du professeur Andrew Waterhouse se passe aussi dans un contexte qui va voir l'achèvement d'un bâtiment qui va héberger très prochainement nos collègues qui s'inscrivent donc dans le cadre de l'Institut des sciences de la vigne et du vin. Comme vous le savez tous, l'ISVV, puisque c'est l'acronyme, s'est construit grâce au soutien majeur, faut le dire, du Conseil régional d'Aquitaine et a bénéficié d'une dynamique collective et en particulier du dynamisme de son directeur, le professeur Serge Delrault, ici présent, que je tiens à saluer. Alors, cet institut, en deux mots, a pour vocation, pour ceux qui ne le savent pas, à fédérer dans un même ensemble la formation, la recherche et le transfert technologique dans le domaine des sciences de la vigne et du vin. Et je crois qu'on va avoir un outil, parce que c'est qu'un outil, un bâtiment, mais qui va regrouper en fait en un seul lieu, pratiquement en tout cas, l'essentiel des recherches dans ce domaine. Et ça va être, à mon sens, un catalyseur qui va amplifier, en fait, la visibilité, mais aussi l'excellence, etc., qui va permettre de diriger les projecteurs aussi vers ces recherches. Alors, pour revenir à la conférence du professeur Andrew Waterhouse, alors moi je ne suis pas du tout un spécialiste du domaine, mais j'ai fait comme tous les scientifiques, j'ai regardé un petit peu la bibliographie. Alors on voit que c'est un grand spécialiste des composés phénoliques du vin. Il a beaucoup publié d'articles sur ce domaine. Alors ce qu'on trouve aussi, c'est qu'il a, donc c'est un spécialiste du vin, mais il a aussi publié sur le chocolat. Et j'ai compris en fait pourquoi, parce que dans le chocolat, on trouve aussi des molécules qui sont des antioxydants et qui peuvent constituer donc un bénéfice pour la santé. Et j'imagine qu'il va nous parler de ces molécules à la fois en fait extrêmement agréables au goûter lorsqu'on déguste du vin, mais aussi potentiellement bénéfiques pour la santé.
Well, thank you very much. I apologize, I won't be speaking in French today. I want to thank all of you for the kind introduction. It is really an honor to be here, and I think I'll speak about that a little bit more later this afternoon. But I greatly appreciate the chance to speak to this important group here. And I'm going to speak about a little my perspective on the history of wine and health and show that there are important connections between our two institutions. So I'm going to start by mentioning that, of course, wine has been considered healthy for at least 1,000 years, perhaps longer, by very many cultures who have consumed wine. But in the modern era of science, those old descriptions of the healthfulness of wine were sort of forgotten until recently, at least perhaps not in France, but at least in the US, wine was not considered a healthy beverage until recently. And I want to point out relatively early paper was published by St. Leger. And I'm just going to mention this because this was published in 1979, and I've listed here on the slide the actual title, Factors Associated with Cardiac Mortality in Developed Countries with Particular Reference to the Consumption of Wine. So when this was published, nothing happened, and no one paid any attention. And it really wasn't until almost the same information was presented in a slightly different form by a very important professor from this university, Serge Renaud, where he used the word French paradox. And I honestly believe that we would not be having this discussion if he didn't use that term, which caught the imagination of many people, scientists, the public, reporters. And this catalyzed the interest in the subject. Because if he hadn't used such a clear word that caught attention, I don't think we would be having this discussion. And then I'm going to go on to show a little bit how that played out in terms of explanations. So I've listed on the top here the title, Wine, Alcohol, Platelets, and the French Paradox for Coronary Heart Disease. So this is the actual title of the paper that Renaud published in 1991. And this stimulated a huge amount of interest internationally. In the US, Renaud was on television multiple times. But remember that when this report was published, the word paradox meant there was no explanation for the observed effect. What Renaud observed is that wine drinkers were protected against heart disease, but he had no clear explanation for it. He could only say that the alcohol perhaps had some effect, but it was no explanation, so it was a paradox. So that left the question open. How can this be explained? And there are a couple of theories that then came from this. And I think this antioxidant hypothesis actually came from Davis. And so this is the real clear connection between our two institutions. And it was John Kinsella, who was actually the dean of the College of Agriculture, that worked with a group of other scientists on campus and came up with this idea. It was based on recent theories that suggested that heart disease or the formation of atherosclerosis, atherogenesis, was based on oxidation in the bloodstream. And they knew that wine contained polyphenols, which were antioxidants. So they connected the health effect observed by Renault with the composition of wine as it contained an antioxidant. And this was a very powerful hypothesis. And this paper then launched many, many investigations about effects of antioxidants in general. And I have a photograph here up of John Kinsella. Unfortunately, just a few years, actually 1 year after this was published, he passed away with a sudden heart attack himself. There was also another proposition, another theory proposed by Leroy Creasy, who was a viticulturalist from Cornell University. And it was based on the idea that he showed that wine contained resveratrol, which was not known up to that time. It was known to exist in vines and in grapes, but it was not known to exist in wine. So he showed by analysis that wine contained resveratrol. And resveratrol is also the major ingredient of an herbal medicine used in Asia. The botanical name is Polygonum cuspidatum. And it was shown that resveratrol had antioxidant properties, and it was prescribed, this medicine was prescribed for heart disease in Asia. We then actually, my laboratory prepared resveratrol synthetically and showed that it also had specific antioxidant properties, which we related back to the antioxidant hypothesis. You may have heard recently that there is a lot of interest in resveratrol, and this is based on completely unrelated discoveries that happened about 10 years ago related to the anti-cancer effects of resveratrol. So today there are somewhere in the order of 5,000 papers published each year on resveratrol. And luckily for the wine industry, when these papers are published, the newspapers often report this and start with the line that resveratrol, a substance found in red wine. Now, the amount needed in these studies is about 1,000 times more than you can get in a glass of wine, but it doesn't hurt too much to always mention that resveratrol is in wine. But if you want to have the effect of resveratrol, it will be difficult to get that from wine. So the research then came to the question, how much of these antioxidants are present in wine? What are they? How do we quantify them? And this started with a collaboration between my laboratory and laboratory in food science and technology. And to get this started, I needed someone to come and start doing some analysis of antioxidants in wine. And so we had a French visiting scientist showed up in Davis just in the right time. And this is a young fellow named Pierre-Louis Tessedra, who came as a postdoc. And he became an expert on polyphenols in very quick order and generated a lot of data looking at antioxidants and what they were in different wines. So we then created a data set, and this is the actual data, which I don't expect you to read every number here. But in fact, we analyzed the composition of 20 wines total. And it was amazing how the newspapers took this data and postulated that, for instance, Petite Syrah, which is a very obscure grape in France, no one would even consider drinking it, had the highest level of antioxidants based on two data points, and so on. But this was really the first revelation of the amount of polyphenols in wine and showed that it related to the antioxidant effect across a large number of samples. So we have actual chemical composition data, antioxidant effect, and a variety of grapes. And we also measured the amount of resveratrol. So we did show that the phenolic compounds, which we could measure, were responsible for the antioxidant activity in wine. So there's a clear relationship there. We also showed that the red varieties had much more, and the dark red varieties, like Petite Syrah, had the highest amount. But we also showed that the resveratrol levels were really unrelated to the amount of total antioxidants, and so probably not the key component responsible for this. And I'm sure also a picture showing much younger people than we have today. This work was conducted in a collaboration with Ed Frankel, who was in the food science department at Davis. And he had the antioxidant test, which, as Dr. Tessedra learned, and many students also learned, was the most difficult possible way to measure antioxidants you could imagine. It took about a week to get 12 data points. It took human blood. We had to isolate lipids from human blood. It was really difficult. Unfortunately, if you work with Ed Frankel, you must use his method. So that was his method. But it was a very good collaboration. We then, the next question is that you have these antioxidants present in the wine, and really the next question is, does it get into the bloodstream if it has an effect on cardiovascular disease? Does the phenols get in? So the next question was, can we measure the polyphenols in the blood, and how would we do that? And started developing a procedure, and I've listed three people here, including Dr. Tessedra, who got involved in creating the procedures. And he then came back to France, and other people continued the study. And just to mention, the student who did most of the work then that eventually got published once we had the methods developed was Jennifer Donovan. And we did publish this in the Journal of Nutrition and also American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. So we're actually able to show that a specific polyphenol named catechin from wine got into the bloodstream, and we actually showed which forms were present. So now we know that the antioxidants are present in the wine and that they do get into the bloodstream. The amount was not very much, though. This graph doesn't really show that, but the amount was very small. It was quite difficult to do these analyses because the amounts were very low. But we did show what was present and that it did get in. So this was an important advance. And just to show another picture here of our research team, different people from food science, perhaps. Dr. Tessedra remembers this nice lunch outside in Davis one day. Now, as I mentioned, this antioxidant hypothesis was very powerful in terms of explaining the reduction in disease amongst wine drinkers. And there's also very good epidemiology, showing that fruit consumption is related to reduced heart disease. And fruit, of course, is what wine is made from. And fruit consumption is also related to polyphenol consumption. So there is a tremendous incentive to study this question further. And this shows that over a 15, 16-year period, that the number of studies that analyzed antioxidants became a very, very large number. And I don't think this is going down yet. There's still tremendous interest in studying antioxidants. And you can see in many journals that people are studying antioxidants in almost any food that they can do measurements on. So this stimulated what I would call a popular concept that the antioxidants increase health, reduce disease, because the antioxidants are capturing the free radicals. So the free radicals are bad, they're circulating in our bloodstream, and the antioxidants are mopping it up. So this lists three different descriptions from various types of sources, some authoritative and some not so authoritative. But this is very widely disseminated in the press, that the reason wine is good for you is it contains antioxidants that get in your blood and remove those nasty free radicals, and that's what saves you. Looks like that unhappy face there is supposed to be a micromolar. I guess we don't have all the fonts on this computer. So what we've been learning lately, though, is that The amount of polyphenols that get into the bloodstream is really not sufficient to have a chemical effect as an antioxidant. That the amount of amount needed for actually removing those antioxidants is in the micromolar level, and the amount we've ever been able to detect, the most we've ever been able to detect of all polyphenols in the blood might be 1 micromolar, and usually it's 10 or 100 times less nanomolar level. So the amount of these polyphenols getting into the blood, it doesn't seem possible they could actually be acting as an antioxidant. So the mentioned a few other things. They're also converted into various forms. The body is very efficient at converting these into different forms, which are actually less active as antioxidants. So it doesn't seem that the amount present of these polyphenols could actually have an antioxidant effect in the bloodstream where disease is being prevented. And one of the reasons is that we already have very strong antioxidants present in our bloodstream all the time at very high levels. We have ascorbate, we have uriate, we have tocopherols, we have glutathione. These are the endogenous antioxidants that are really there controlling redox reactions in our blood. And so the question then is, how are the polyphenols having an effect? It doesn't seem possible that they actually could be reducing oxidation in the bloodstream. So I said even a perfect antioxidant would not be effective at the levels we're observing that. Okay, so this restates what I already said. So we and others are beginning to think that the real explanation is the what's called the inflammation pathway. So this is a very specific pathway. It's a little confusing because inflammation is often related to oxidation. But there are very specific steps that occur in the inflammatory process. It's very complicated. In fact, I can't really even begin pretend to tell you that I understand how all this works, because there's so many different interconnected steps that control inflammation through the immune system. But both heart disease and cancer are tied to this process, the inflammatory process in our bodies. And so the question then is, could polyphenols be affecting this inflammation process in the body? And that's the question we and others are now pursuing. And this mentions several different other authors who have been reporting various things related to this. So NF-kappa B is a very important linchpin in the inflammatory process. And this is actually a professor at Davis in the nutrition department has shown that polyphenols specifically bind to NF-kappa B, which is a protein, and result in specific tests, lower inflammatory response. There's a process by which blood clots are broken down called fibrinolysis. So if you can increase fibrinolysis, you reduce blood clotting. And this professor, Françoise Boisy at University of Alabama, Birmingham, a medical research university, found that specific polyphenols from wine actually had an effect on this process as well at very low levels, nanomolar levels. So again, looking at a very specific pathway related to inflammation. And Helmut Zeiss, who's perhaps one of the best chemists in the field of free radical reactions in biological systems, showed that methylated epicatechin, which is one of the important phenols present in wine, also in chocolate, if chocolate is of interest, and in many other foods as well, including tea. But methylated epicatechin has an extremely powerful effect on inhibiting superoxide production. And it turns out that's very important because superoxide is used by the bodies to regulate NO levels, which is like the molecule that controls vascular dilation. So now we're beginning to see very specific molecular explanations for how tiny, tiny levels of polyphenols could actually be having an effect on disease. If we're actually affecting vascular dilation with tiny amounts of polyphenols, which should be present, the methylated compounds are going to be present, then we are starting to see real explanations for how this process could be affected and how health could be affected by consumption of wine. When we started looking at this question, we decided to approach this from a slightly different direction. Being chemists, we look at the amount of polyphenols in the bloodstream, and we said, well, there's just not very much there, but there's a lot of polyphenols in the gut. If they're not being absorbed, they must remain in the gut. So we said, well, look, do we have any data on effects in the gut? And started looking at some specific tests for this. And one of the reasons we decided to do this is that there actually were a few studies showing that wine drinkers had lower rates of colon cancer. So this was very interesting. So if these polyphenols are remaining in the gut, they could be reducing disease. And we decided to look at a number of different compounds. And it gets a little bit complicated. I'll just point out some of the people who worked on the study with us. The fellow on the right, actually interesting, this was one of my high school classmates. So it was very funny. I hadn't been in touch with him for really 25 years. And he has a very unusual name, as you can see, Hashayarsha Chazai. So I was searching on Google, and I wasn't finding him. And then, by accident, one time I decided to search in the scientific literature, and his name came up. And he actually is an immunologist studying colon cancer. So we met at a reunion, and he said, you know, we can do an experiment together. So it was very funny to meet a high school classmate from 30 years ago and do an experiment with him. So we wanted to look at the metabolites that could be present in the gut. And these are some of the compounds we looked at. These are very simple acids, phenolic acids, which we postulate could have been present when polyphenols are broken down in the gut. And actually, I've got data on this later. So we looked at these compounds and actually did find some interesting results. I'm not going to try to explain the details of the assay, but we looked at a cell proliferation assay. And this is actually a treatment, a positive control, showing that with this positive control, you get less proliferation. And then we showed this compound had very little effect, but gallic acid had a very strong effect at suppressing proliferation. So some of these simple polyphenols, which could be derived from metabolism of wine flavonoids, do seem to have effect in this particular cell system. The friend also had an animal model. He actually has specific mice called APC mice that develop colon cancer. And we actually then treated the mice with gallic acid because we were running out of time, as sometimes this happens even to scientists. You know, get busy and can't quite get things and do it the way you'd like. So we actually used an injection of gallic acid instead of feeding gallic acid. But that way we knew the mice were being exposed to gallic acid. So we treated these mice. Now, these mice essentially are bred genetically to produce colon cancer. And the question is, could these compounds reduce the development of the disease? So it's a model. It's an animal model. And we wanted to see if we had an effect. And this just shows that mast cell formation, which one of the things we look at, is in fact related to polyps or polyposis in the colon in these animals. And we showed that mast cell formation was greatly reduced. And so this shows that mast cell formation is related to polyps. And we showed that gallic acid actually reduced the formation of mast cells, which is one of the cell types in the immune system. Please don't ask me any questions about mast cells. I have no idea how to explain it. But we definitely showed that in this tissue, in the mice, the treatment with gallic acid suppressed the formation of mast cells. And this just shows some pictures of how we do the measurement. In the tissue, you can see the mast cells light up very brightly as the red marked cells. And we also show that the number of polyps in the or pre-tumorous, pre-cancerous polyp formation in the intestine was also reduced. So this was a very promising result, which we're going to follow up on in the future, that the polyphenols like gallic acid, a very simple one, could actually have an effect on disease development. Granted, this is an animal model and so on, but it's a very promising result. And so this gets back to the study we're doing right now, which is to look specifically at some compounds and their effect. How could they affect the colon cancer development? And a student working on this project observed that there were many studies linking anthocyanin consumption with reduced colon cancer. Now, anthocyanin are the red pigments in grapes and also in young red wine. Unfortunately, if you drink nicely well-aged red wine, there isn't much anthocyanin left. But if you drink young red wine, there can be a lot left in young wine. So the question then is, if you consume these anthocyanins, then what happens to them in the gut? It turns out in the gut, we have, in the lower intestine in particular, we have this huge number of bacteria that convert all sorts of things to different substances. So there's a very rapid transformation of polyphenols and other chemicals once they get to the lower intestine. And the question is, what happens to anthocyanins when they get there? So this just shows some pictures of anthocyanins. If you're a chemist, you'll appreciate this. If you're not, it doesn't make any sense. And so the experiment was to look at a model of what happens in the gut. So we actually isolated pure anthocyanins from grapes. This was actually a mixture of just the anthocyanins. We then added this to pig intestinal contents. So getting actual contents of human colon is a little difficult and painful. So, but at Davis, we have an animal science department, and they actually have animals there. So we could go to the barn and get a piece of intestinal contents from a pig that was just recently alive. So it's very convenient to have these other types of facilities at UC Davis. We then take that, now that's now a model for what would happen in a human colon. We actually selected the pig because their gut is supposed to be very close in comparison to, or close to, human gut. And we look to see what happens. What happens to these anthocyanins? And what we observed were three new compounds. The two on the right have been reported before as metabolites of various flavonoids. The one on the left was a new compound. So, in fact, we couldn't buy it. We had to actually chemically synthesize the compound on the left. So these were three compounds that appear spontaneously when anthocyanins were placed into the pig intestinal contents. And this is the student who did the study. And we're actually able to show that the anthocyanin levels go down, and the data on the top shows the degradation over 2 and 6 hours, or this is no, half hour and 6 hours. And we showed that the anthocyanins are broken down even in sterilized pig guts, pig intestinal contents, but there actually is specific activity in the live bacteria that actively degrade these more quickly than simple chemical degradation. And so this showed that there are microbes present which specifically degrade anthocyanins to the compounds I just showed you. And so we showed that on a couple different ways. We also showed the appearance of these compounds. So, in fact, these compounds themselves are further broken down, which would be expected. But the levels are fairly high in 30 minutes and then degrade but are still present after 6 hours. So it showed that the compounds I just presented, these three chemicals, actually are formed specifically from grape anthocyanins. And then the question is, are these compounds interest further, have further interest? And that really is what we're pursuing right now. So we're trying to find out if these specific chemicals that are formed, do they have effects? We have a preliminary data showing on some simple colon cancer models that they do have some effects, some significant effects. We're also interested in showing whether these chemicals show up in humans. So we're planning to feed people some anthocyanins and then look to see in their blood or urine, do these specific same compounds appear? As if metabolites are being formed, they should appear in the bloodstream. And that would confirm that these compounds should be pursued. If, for instance, perhaps in humans, different metabolites are formed, in which case studying the activity of these compounds would perhaps not quite be so interesting. And then, of course, ultimately, we'd like to show that food consumption at normal levels, perhaps a nice glass of wine, does this produce adequate levels of these substances to have an actual biological response? So this is a very critical study that would need to be done in the future. And then, of course, is there a real linkage between these compounds, the response, and disease? And, you know, is a clinical study in the offing? This is actually an interesting hypothetical question. Can we do a clinical study, clinical trial, with food or with wine? It couldn't be blind it would be very hard to find subjects who actually couldn't tell whether they're drinking wine or something else. And there's actually some debate now amongst a few people in the U.S. that they're thinking it might be possible to do a clinical study for a limited period of time. I think it's going to be very difficult to do. Part of the problem is compliance, getting subjects to change their diet, to change their alcohol consumption, to meet the requirements of the study, which could go, for instance, for 6 months or a year. It turns out it's very hard to get people to change their diets, as we find trying to get people to eat better food. It's very hard for people to change their diet. So to get them to completely change their alcohol consumption would be very difficult. But it seems it might be possible to do, and that would be the real important study to do in the end. I should mention that our research was supported by a number of different organizations, including the E&J Gallo Company, which was a very good supporter for a few years. The Wine Spectator, perhaps you've heard of that magazine. The publisher of the Wine Spectator actually is supporting some of this research. The John and Kinsella Endowed Chair and these other fine organizations. And with that, I guess I'll stop and thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to take any questions.
I had a question. I was wondering, both in terms of inflammation and also in when you are looking at the guts, did you look at the properties of these phenolic compounds in terms of antimicrobial activities? How do typical bacteria react with these molecules? Are they inhibitory or?
We've done some studies, but only with food-grade microbes. So we've looked at the interaction with lactic acid bacteria, a number of those, and these compounds seem to have no effect on the bacteria. Yeah. The chemicals that are known to break down the polyphenols are, let's say not so interesting because they're not food-grade bacteria and they're difficult to handle. They are strict anaerobes, and so it's difficult to do studies on them. But we're debating whether to investigate this. I doubt the polyphenols would actually create too much inhibition Well, let me take I'll take that back. Some microbes use these chemicals as a source or a sink, as an oxidation sink, because the conversions that are occurring are reduction reactions. So in the strict anaerobic environment of the gut, it's very important to find a molecule that you can reduce. And so these are being reduced, chemically reduced, and to provide energy to the microbes. But some of them probably are affected. I have heard of a few studies suggesting that the ecology of the gut could be affected by a polyphenol high diet. But I'm not, perhaps someone else here is aware of a study like that. I'm not sure. I think at breakfast, perhaps. Personally, I find it difficult to drink wine at breakfast. So perhaps at breakfast, chocolate would be better, or tea. Of course, it's also possible that the combinations have a special effect, which maybe is more romantic than scientific, but I think chocolate and wine together is a very good combination. Yeah, the question is ethanol have a potentiating effect? Actually, in the study we did on catechin, we actually compared the metabolism with and without alcohol, and there was really zero effect. So I don't think the alcohol, at least at normal levels, so this was an interesting study. We had subjects come to the laboratory at 8 a.m., have no breakfast before, and immediately drink a large glass of red wine. And then we took blood samples the rest of the day. At lunch, we gave them a turkey sandwich. That's all they got to eat for the rest of the day. But in that study, we saw no difference between subjects that had wine or de-alcoholized wine. Actually, even to be totally careful, we took some wine, we de-alcoholized it, and then we added water to one sample and ethanol to the other. So we had exactly the same beverage, but the only difference was the ethanol, and we didn't see any effect. So we were hoping to see some effect, but we didn't. So I don't think that has. Yes, the question is, in the U.S., have I observed any political resistance to a good, let's say, wine is good for you message? And yes, not very often, but very occasionally, professors in our department will get messages from people who complain that we shouldn't be promoting the evil beverage that contains alcohol. But these are infrequent and obviously not frequent. That we, you know, there's not too many people who feel that strongly about it. However, one of the studies I mentioned, a fellow named Francois Boisy, he applied for funding from NIH, which is really the top medical research foundation in the United States and distributes billions of dollars each year. And their review process is considered extremely rigorous and totally controlled by science. So the strongest scientific studies get funded, period. But his study was actually pulled out of the list for 1 year because of political decision. So in the review process, he was given the second rank out of, they reviewed, I don't know, 10 studies. They had enough money for 4 studies, and his was ranked second, and it was taken out of the list and was not funded. It's the only time I've ever heard of NIH review process being compromised by politics. And it was because they didn't want a study that might show that wine could be good for you. Which, of course, is very disappointing. But he fought the decision and eventually was able to get the study funded. Although they did refuse to fund one part of the study, which made it difficult to tie everything together. But that's So it was, yes, there are specific problems trying to get this message across. Now, one of the reasons, of course, is that there's a political perspective that alcohol consumption will lead to, if you promote alcohol consumption, it will lead to alcohol abuse. And unfortunately, I should have put this data in this slide set, but a few months ago, there was a very interesting study that came out. And the data is actually just shocking. What they did was they compared people who consumed, I think this was done in Denmark, so they had people who consumed really no wine, some wine, which was about 10% of their alcohol consumption, and then they had people who consumed a lot of wine, which in this population was 30% or more of total alcohol. And then they looked at these people, so they gathered this data in year one, and then 5 years later, they looked at how many people had been treated for alcohol problems, which was very specific. They asked, have you been treated by a medical doctor for alcohol abuse, or have you been hospitalized for alcohol problems? So these are very specific, hard endpoints. They didn't ask, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? It was medical treatment for alcohol. And then they compared these populations of low, medium, and high wine consumption. Now, among women, for instance, they showed that the women who are consuming two or more drinks per day, which was the highest category in this study, the non-wine consumers had a problem rate of 15, and the wine consumers had a problem rate of 3. So this is a five times, 500% difference between the wine consumers and the non-wine consumers. So it actually, this data suggests that wine consumption reduces the problems with alcohol, the problems of alcohol abuse. Now in the men, they had an even more interesting result. It showed that among the men who consumed 1 to 2 drinks per day of wine, let me explain that the control group was the people who didn't drink anything. Okay? So people who didn't drink anything and the reporting, right, they had some problems. I mean, not many, but some of those people, after 5 years, were treated for alcohol problems. Okay? I don't know. They started drinking, they, you know, whatever, right? Maybe they weren't so honest. I don't know. If we look at the men who consumed 1 to 2 drinks per day, their rate of problems was lower than 1. This suggests the way to prevent alcohol abuse is to drink wine moderately. Now, it's really an amazing way of interpreting the data, but I mean, I think that's what the data says. If you want to reduce alcohol abuse, you should consume wine moderately. So, to those people who say that, you know, all alcohol is bad, I want them to see this data. It's really remarkable. So I think there's reason to believe that, and I have, I don't know how much time I have left. I actually think this is because wine has specific properties that make it consumed with food. It's sour and astringent, and it's difficult to abuse wine. I mean, some people can, but I find it difficult to just sit and drink a whole bottle of red wine by itself. I believe it can be done, but it's not pleasant. And so wine actually has a sensory impact that makes it difficult to drink it abusively. On the other hand, it complements food very well. So there's an incentive to consume it with food. When you do that, you actually reduce blood alcohol content and reduce the chances for abusive behavior. So.
Thank you very much. Aussi pour les étudiants, donc le message pour ce soir, c'est un verre, deux maximum, mais pas la bouteille. Très bien.